Thanks so much, Greg. I'm backstage, thrilled to be backstage with our maestra, Jane Glover. Welcome back to Philadelphia, Jane.
It's just wonderful to be here with this wonderful orchestra. I'm having the time of my life. Thank you.
That's so great. It was really a radiant first half, and I was just so interested that you started with Mozart's very first symphony when he was only 8 years old and spending time in your home country. Why do you think it's important to perform and listen to Juvenilia of a Genius?
Well, it's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, I find that first symphony irresistible. I think it's actually a delicious little piece, and I could name you a dozen grown-up composers writing music in 1764, which is nothing like as good as that. I mean, it astonishes me every time I do it that this is the work of an eight-year-old. You know, the slow movement is a little short of ideas, maybe, but he's certainly got a feeling for texture and line and contrast and drama and colour, and you know, even with just a small forces of strings and oboes and bassoons, he gets so much out of it. And he's 8 years old, you know, it's just phenomenal. But I think in a program when we are doing, as we are about to, the Jupiter Symphony, which is just one of the most mighty symphonies we have in the repertoire, not just his repertoire, but the whole repertoire, it's really interesting to see where it started, you know. There are people say to me after having heard Symphony No. 1, oh, what did I do here, that four-note thing of the Jupiter Symphony in there? And I think that is coincidental, but it's just really interesting to see, as it were, the alpha and the omega of Mozart's symphonic career and feel the growth between them. And therefore, it's been lovely to do, you know, his first solo concerto that we know about, this bassoon concerto, very, very young. For me, this is a just delicious program altogether.
Well, I really get that sense from your conducting that there is a great sense of conversation. And also the timing that you bring to your conducting, the dramatic pauses, those are all very operatic and also very human. Is there something in your influences and your concept that allows you to paint this sort of musical picture?
Well, that's very interesting. I do work a lot in opera, as you probably know, and I've conducted all the Mozart operas a lot, and I think Mozart was always fundamentally a dramatist. You know, he loved telling stories. You read his letters, and they're just so narrative. There is, as you say, this human element. We never lose sight of who he is, or what he is, the story he's trying to tell us. And I think this is his greatness, actually. And I find this, you know, for this program, for instance, the Jupiter Symphony, which we're about to do, I couldn't tell you the number of times I've done it, but, you know, I'm so old, I've been doing this for a long time. But, you know, every time, you know, one is just bowled over by the genius of it. You can never think, oh, yeah, this is the Jupiter, this is how it goes, and fax it in. You know, he just makes you discover it again and again, and you find new things in it every time, and you find the exuberance and the sort of innovation of it every time. And there are not many composers who do that to you every time, you know.
Well, that slow movement in particular, the harmonic progressions are almost shockingly different and inventive. Yes,
absolutely. They're not just the harmonic progressions, but the fact that we in a sense, you know, you get these in a slow tempo, you get these multiple hemiolas, so that you really lose sight really of where the first beat of the bar is. I mean, and there is a sense of inner turmoil in him at this point, which there was. I mean, you know, the story of him writing the last three symphonies, 39, 14, 41, in the course of 6 weeks, in probably the most depressed state of his whole life. And he didn't have a commission for these symphonies. He didn't have a reason to write them. He just sat down and wrote these three great symphonies. And I think the reason for this is that music for him was an escape. That everything that was going wrong in his life, you know, he'd just lost a child, his daughter had died, he had no job, he was desperately short of money. That's the time when he hadn't got any money at all, and he was writing heartbreaking letters to friends and colleagues saying, could you just lend me $1,000, or could you lend me a fiver, you know, anything. You cannot read these letters without weeping copiously. Then he sits down and writes these three symphonies, and I think it's, as I say, an escape for him. It's another world where he can be happy, in a sense, where his genius can rise and fly. But in places like the slow movement of the Jupiter, we feel the tragedy coming through, we feel the turmoil of what he's going through, and he breaks your heart in that slow mood, and then we go to a minuet which has just got so much life and joy and dance in it.
And so much charm. And then in the final movement, he inserts that amazing amount of counterpoint and then extraordinary fugue. Why do you think he leaves that for the last movement?
That complete exuberance is he's just letting it all go. He's just writing with reckless, effortless abandon. I love it that it's effortless, this five-part invertible counterpoint. I mean, it's astonishing. And yet he makes it feel completely natural and normal. You know, all his life he'd loved puzzles and codes and ciphers and secrets. And so writing five-part invertible counterpoint is just another sort of puzzle for him, I think.
I would love to talk about your incredible versatility as an artist. You're a conductor, a broadcaster, an author, and I'm referring especially to your award-winning book on Mozart and the women in his life. You humanize his life and relationships in such a real way. And for instance, would you allow me to quote from early on in the book, "Yet for all that his brilliance was universally recognized and praised, he could secure no permanent employment and entered the wholly precarious world of life as a freelance musician." Times really haven't changed that much, have they?
No, they haven't, but he was one of the first to do that, you know, and that's what's so precarious about it, that most composers, I mean, Haydn, of course, is the obvious person, you know, needed a good patron. Without that security of having your bread and butter on the table, life is really difficult. And, you know, unfortunately, in Mozart's case, he was so hopeless with money. Absolutely useless. And, you know, if he had it, he spent it. And if he didn't have it, he went on spending it. And as it happens, I've just finished writing a book about Handel. And, you know, he was brilliant with money. I mean, he wasn't just also a just wonderful composer who produced masterpiece after masterpiece and moved so many goalposts so that everybody else could grow and achieve. But he also had this amazing business sense, and he knew how to make money and how to handle money and how to get money for his projects and how to spend it properly. Mozart didn't understand any of that. And I sort of love him for that, but I also, you know, I love him anyway. I love Handel too, but you see what I mean? There is this immense sort of human side to him, which I've often been told that certainly in my book on Mozart, I feel quite maternal towards him, and I think I probably do.
And very protective.
Yes, indeed.
We can't wait to hear the Jupiter Symphony and also read your new book.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
Not a bit. Great pleasure.
Bye-bye.